In the new book, Beyond Contempt, Erica Edelson shows us how to communicate respectfully, passionately, and effectively across the political divide without soft-pedaling our beliefs. Using non-defensive communication skill sets, she says we can express ourselves in ways that inspire open-minded consideration instead of triggering defensive reaction. Beyond Contempt looks to foster productive dialogue that can diffuse hostility, build trust, and open hearts and minds in unexpected ways. Erica Edelson is a writer, community activist, and certified powerful non-defensive communication facilitator, and we welcome her to the program this morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm very good. Thank you so much.
Very nice to have you on the program. Let us begin with the obvious, which is, what is a powerful non-defensive communication facilitator?
Oh, well, so powerful non-defensive communication itself is a non-adversarial communication method developed by a woman named Sharon Strand Ellison, who has trained a lot of educators and nonprofit and corporate leaders to resolve conflicts, be they interpersonal conflicts or group conflicts, by communicating in ways that avoid triggering defensiveness. So I have gone through a number of her training sessions, enough to be called a certified powerful non-defensive communication facilitator. My primary outlet for putting those skills to work is in the political arena, because I am politically active in electoral campaigns and other kinds of social justice causes. And then, of course, in my book is really kind of a translation of what I have come to understand to be effective communication, translating that from the interpersonal and professional realm to show how it can apply in the political and electoral realm.
You think of a chasm that we have between people and a divide, and we are polarized, and we hear those terms a lot. One of the things about your book I find interesting is you use the word contempt, and that's a really strong word, but it's applicable, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, the title itself, Beyond Contempt, is a play on the expression beneath contempt, which is something that we say when we judge someone to be, you know, so evil or wrongheaded that we don't want to have anything to do with them. And if we do stoop to talk to them, it's only to tell them how wrong and stupid they are. So what I'm inviting people to do in the book, if they want to, is to try to move beyond that contempt state, to put aside the feeling that the other person is totally irredeemable, and try to meet them where they're at instead of where you wish they were at. And I'll say that, you know, this book is not a prescription for people. It's an invitation to consider going through a journey that I myself had to go through, because as someone who's very left and cares a lot about politics and was just devastated and heartbroken and enraged kind of beyond words when Donald Trump was elected, I really had to go through a whole experience of going pretty deep into feeling an enormous amount of contempt, and then almost getting like a contempt hangover, just sort of feeling addicted to it, poisoned by it, and kind of coming to see that I could liberate myself from it and not only be more effective in my communication, but just kind of feel better. Because at the end of the day, I think, I don't want to speak for other people, but for myself, once I stopped experiencing so much contempt and stopped slinging so much contempt out into the world, I actually just kind of felt like almost like a burden was lifted from my soul.
So how were you able to do that? And I guess the way of asking that to you is, what does that liberation, in your case, what does that liberation look like?
Well, so I live in the leftist bubble of Berkeley, California. And so that means that unless I really make an effort, I hardly even get a chance to talk to people across the divide.
Right.
So I had to make a decision at a certain point, because as you said, we are so polarized, we're so sorted by zip code, we stick to our tribe or our faction. So I decided that I was going to really make an effort to talk to people across the divide, and I did it in two ways. One was that I joined a group called Better Angels, which hosts what they call red-blue workshops, which are dialogues where they bring people together. And the other thing that I've done is canvassing door-to-door in swing districts. So I had some experience doing that in a Central Valley district that we flipped in the midterms. And then I actually went out to Kentucky for that gubernatorial election just a few months ago. And so, yeah, I mean, it was getting out of my bubble, and it also involves putting aside two things that are very strong in me, especially since I used to be a lawyer. One is the need to convince the other person, and the other is this tendency to judge. It's this self-righteous feeling that, you know, I'm right and they're wrong, and so the goal of this conversation is for me to show them how right I am and how wrong they are, and the way I'm going to do that is by insulting them. So now I've just said what not to do, and so what do you do instead? Well, my touchstone when I feel offended or bewildered by something that someone has said that's either offensive or counterfactual is something that the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh said, which is, speak the truth, but not to punish. And I just love that quote, because speak the truth, okay, so I'm going to say what I feel, I'm going to share my story, I'm going to share my values, I'm going to share my thought process, I'm going to say everything that I want to say, but then I'm not going to tack on a punishment, a verbal tongue lashing or an insult or a judgment about the other person.
So even if you can have a rational conversation, whatever that is, your definition may vary, but if you can have a rational conversation, what's the end game? I mean, if we can agree to disagree, is that enough?
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard because the hardest part of this work is putting aside your agenda in any given conversation. Because if you go in, like I was just saying, if you go in with an agenda to convince, the other person picks up on that and they're going to get defensive. So even though, like, somewhere in the back of my mind or deep in my heart, yes, of course I do want to convince them, but I sort of have to do a little mental jiu-jitsu on myself before I start interacting with the person to say, you know, all I'm going to do here is find out where they're at and tell them where I'm at and walk away. And I will either have planted a seed or not. And I may never know. I mean, the goal certainly can't be that at the end of the conversation, the person's going to say, darn it, you're right. My God, I've been wrong my entire life. And thank you for showing me the light. I mean, there's a couple stories in the book where like there's a profound turnaround like that. But most of the time it is more subtle, and we don't know in a specific case, but we do have some sense across the board that some of these conversations, like in the midterms and in the Kentucky governor's election, were having a positive impact in terms of, you know, the political scientists who go in and analyze this stuff after elections could see that there were people who voted for Trump and then voted for a Democrat in the midterms, or voted for Trump and then voted for Andy Beshear, the Democrat, in the Kentucky election. So change is possible. There are still a lot of ambivalent Trump voters out there. And, you know, as one of them said in an article I read recently, you need to give us a way to admit that we made a mistake without making us feel bad about it.
We just had a 2-hour panel discussion, as we do here on this program every day. And we were talking about the likelihood that the president will be acquitted, and that will happen within the next few hours, if not day and a half. And we were talking about it, I wouldn't say lightly, but we were basically to terms with it that this is going to happen. And we got a letter from someone who was outraged that we weren't outraged, that this was a day that would look down and was basically the crumbling of our democracy and our freedoms. I see both points, but I don't know, you know, if we're going to fight things, do we need to be angrier? Do we need to take to the streets with pots and pans? What is it that we have to do?
Sure. I mean, I think that anger and direct action demonstrations on the streets or wherever, those are very important tools in our toolbox. I mean, you sometimes even just for your own self, you absolutely have to register your anger and outrage because that is what you're genuinely feeling, and to bottle it up is just not even healthy for yourself. I think the trick is that if you're at a level 10 outrage every hour of every day and everything you say, then, you know, it's kind of the old thing. Like if everything's outrageous, then nothing's outrageous.
Right.
I think certainly the acquittal of the president after the kind of sham trial we just saw, I would certainly put that in the category of outrageous. And you can say it. And, you know, going back again to the quote I mentioned, speak the truth, but not to punish. The truth, anger does not have to be, communicating anger does not have to be punitive. I can say that I'm incredibly angry about what's going on, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to, you know, like retaliate in a punitive way against the people who I hold accountable. I can, it's like there can be accountability for wrongdoing in a form that's non-punitive.
When you talk about that, and I guess that one of the problems here is that there's so much to be outraged about, right? I mean, it seems that if in past administrations you think, oh, okay, well, this is we're going to war, so we can be outraged about that. And today, I was looking at the paper last night and prepping for today's show and thinking, well, there's 10 issues here that we can talk about: the environment, we can talk about the bird population, we can talk about the lack of witnesses. There's so much that we can be angry about. So I'm curious and interested in what you just said about, you know, we can be outraged all the time, and it's sort of fine tuning that to figure out where we put our energies.
Yes, and the other part of what I'm saying, and this is why I focused so much on contempt in the book, is because contempt has a unique power to antagonize the other person even more than anger, because contempt is a blend of anger and disgust and superiority. So that's like this triple whammy coming at the person. It's like if someone's mad, I can be like, okay, you're mad. But if they're mad and they're like, I'm mad, you know, and they're accusing me of being a horrible person and they're acting like they're morally superior, whoa, you know, that's like a whole other level. That sends off, you know, all kinds of alarm bells in the brain that trigger like the most intense kind of defensiveness imaginable, which is that you're not only defending yourself, but then you're wanting to retaliate in kind. It makes you very, very hostile toward the person who's conveying contempt to you. So if there's nothing, if I could do one thing in this book and encourage people to, you know, dial back on the contempt and just hold on to the anger, then that in and of itself, I think, would be an improvement.
You know, I was just going to say this to you, but which I think you well know, but it seems the tone of the book, what I got out of it was basically feel how you feel, but just tone it down a little bit, that everybody needs to tone it down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly tone it down. It's sort of like tune it differently, because I would never want to say to someone who has just, you know, suffered the most horrible oppression or loss, like parents who have had their children ripped from their arms at the border, I would never want to say to them, you know, tone it down.
Right.
You know, I mean, people are really suffering.
But I mean globally. I guess what I mean is globally, of how the sides, the tribes, if you will,
sure,
of them, you know, this is the most egregious thing ever done, and then tomorrow, this is the most egregious thing ever done, and then the day after, oh no, this is the most egregious thing ever done.
Right. That absolutely happens. And I think a lot of that is driven by the media, not NPR so much, but the cable news stations. You know, like some people, there's a book that refers to them as the outrage industry because they're stoking that all the time. There was a couple of professors from Tufts who wrote this book and did this study, and they were looking at the top five cable news shows on both sides of the aisle, radio and TV, and they found what they called outrage discourse in 100% of those broadcasts. So you're right, it's constant, and it's stoking not just polarization, but what political scientists call negative polarization, which is even worse than polarization, because what negative polarization refers to is what you're focused on is not so much, oh, I love my tribe so much, we're so great, but I hate the other tribe so much, I will do anything to bring them down.
Doesn't this basically come down to human respect?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it does.
Yeah. Well, the book is fascinating. It is Beyond Contempt. It is by Erica Edelson. Erica, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. Take care.
You too. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.